Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Monday edition, otherwise known as Rethink the Week. And of course, I want to remind everyone that we are Zooming on Sunday, and our three fabulous talkers have agreed to do this on Labor Day weekend. So I am eternally grateful to them for working just like we're working. So thank you, thank you, thank you. But as you've come to expect, we begin our show, and we have for months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And it's his testimony during the impeachment hearings of 2019. And I don't know if you've been following Twitter, but Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has pointed out that he's a sucker, because apparently that's what Donald Trump thinks of him. And then he introduced us to his wife, who's also a sucker, and how proud he was of being sort of accused of that by Donald Trump, because he knows the truth. And when I posted his tweet on my Facebook page, I told my audience how for months we've been doing this and how proud I am that I made that decision. And you'll hear his voice until the election of November 2020. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear, for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, gang, thank you so much on this Labor Day weekend for joining us. Joining us from the great state of Rhode Island is Val Endres. She is a professor at Rhode Island College, a professor in political communications. Let me welcome you back to the program. How are you, Val?
I'm fine, Arnie, and it's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. Dean Spiliotis, I've known him for a really long time. He now teaches at Southern New Hampshire University. He's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar. He has a blog site called nhpoliticalcapital.com. You also can hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. It's good to be with you.
And my old friend, Rick Newman. We've been around too long together, Rick. Rick is a former state representative. He is currently a lobbyist. And we were reminiscing about something that I will be bringing up in about 2 minutes, which is the death of former Governor Steve Merrill, the guy that I ran against in 1992. Welcome back to the program, Rick.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
All right, everyone. I have to take a point of personal privilege. And my point of personal privilege is that in 1991, I ran this quixotic race for governor. I was this young woman with two little kids. I drove a 13-year-old Subaru, didn't have a pot to you know what in, and made the decision that I was gonna run for governor as the first female to run in state history. And on top of that, not only was I gonna run, but I was gonna run on a tax, an income tax, in a state that is notorious for its tax pledge. We don't do broad-based taxes, income or sales, but we do the property tax, which was part of the problem. And in a three-way race, the young woman from the North Country won. On the Republican side, it was also a three-way race. It was a race between the former mayor of Concord. She was also a state representative. And it was the former president of the Senate. And it was John Sununu's attorney general, a fellow by the name of Steve Merrill. And lo and behold, Steve Merrill and Arnie Arneson pull it out. And we now have a sprint to the election. And I was contacted by, I can't even tell you how many hundreds of people saying, did you hear that Steve Merrill died? And to say that I was stunned and shocked is an understatement. It hit me in a way that I can't even describe. I mean, I started to cry. I mean, we were not politically alike, but yet I knew him. So I want to share with you what I posted on Facebook. And what I said was that he ran in 1992 as your traditional uber conservative Republican, but actually he governed as a moderate. And this was my post, everyone. I spent hours with Steve fighting mano a mano for the governorship in 1992. He was smart, charming, politically savvy. My luck to have been handed a very talented competitor. But Steve may have been one of the more moderate Republican governors we've ever had. He appointed his Democratic law partner, John Broderick, to the New Hampshire Supreme Court, who voted in the majority to support the Claremont Education lawsuit, something that gave every Republican agita. He passed the BET, a tax on wages, kind of sounds like an income tax, did an executive order celebrating Martin Luther King's Civil Rights Day within days of taking office, and promised to sign a Martin Luther King Day bill if it ever got to his desk. It did not, and was the first governor to put money into public kindergarten. He kind of sounds almost like the Democratic governors we have elected ever since. I am stunned and saddened by his death. 74 is far too young. And Rick, we were talking just before we started the Zoom session, and when Channel 9 called me, because I'll be on the news tonight, they asked me about my relationship with Steve. And I said, look, obviously I was disappointed that I lost. I think I still would have been a better governor. I said, but you know what? I wanted him to succeed. It was too important that he succeeded. Our state was hemorrhaging after the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. People needed work. Banks needed to be restored. The real estate industry had imploded. How could I not want him to succeed? And frankly, he did. He lucked out, however, because he was able to benefit from a federal scam program called Metascam. But I don't care how he lucked out, the state was better off after 4 years of Steve Merrill. So Rick, you knew him well. We both knew him well. He was kind of charming.
Well, it may sound, it may sound trite to say, but when I was thinking about it last night after I heard about his death, I really thought he was the turning point in an era of the way politics used to be in New Hampshire. When people like you and I, different ends of the spectrum in the Democratic Party, but could still admire a guy like him in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, if you just go back now and think in retrospect, you know, about the time, or right around the time that he left and Gene Shaheen got elected, the Republican Party did take a turn. I mean, it's changed. I have old friends, Sean Jasper, I saw make comments on Facebook about him, and I served with Sean, who's current agriculture secretary, and others. I mean, we all served together, but exactly. We became friends and friendly. And we don't have that today. Steve Merrill was the kind of guy that could get on the floor of the House, as I did, and I spoke against the business enterprise tax bill and called it a giveaway to his corporate cronies. And later in the afternoon, he saw me and slapped me on the back and said, not a bad speech, too bad you lost. And we laughed about it. And, you know, he didn't make you feel like, I wasn't mad at him, he wasn't mad at me. We could be friendly. We could disagree without being disagreeable. The first guy I heard say it, was Hugh Gallon. And Steve Merrill was really cut from the same cloth that Hugh Gallon was.
And Val, Hugh Gallon was a Democrat. Steve Merrill was the Republican. And he's absolutely right. I mean, I grieve now more about politics than people could even imagine, because I came into politics when Republicans and Democrats didn't see each other as the enemy. We understood that most of what we were trying to do was make New Hampshire a better, more stable, more secure state. We could find common ground. We didn't want the other to fail just because they were a Democrat or a Republican. And I watch the politics of today, and I have to tell you, Val, I don't recognize it. I don't understand it. And that's what makes, you know, Donald Trump is everything in the extreme. They were waiting for a Donald Trump. They were grooming a Donald Trump. They were planning for a Donald Trump. You know, if they played out everything they said, he is the poster child for everything that they claimed that they said that they wanted. And I'm just hoping that 2020 isn't just about Donald Trump being removed. It's about we get more sober about what democracy should be about, and that this isn't a war. This is about an election, Val.
I'm less optimistic about that, but I sure hope that you are right. And unfortunately, we're seeing that kind of rancor between Democrats and Republicans, where they declare them each other the enemy, both at the state house and certainly we know it happens in Congress. But we know that the most functional, and if we look at contemporary times from 1960 on, we have countless examples of Democrats and Republicans fighting fiercely, but yet going out to dinner after the session is over and negotiating and coming to some sort of a compromise and living, both parties living to fight another day. And that's the kind of functional government that we signed up for, that we thought that we would have. And I think it's going to take a while. If Joe Biden is reelected, I think that he'll cross the aisle and attempt to mend some bridges. But I also think that we've elected, and particularly in the Republican Party, the extreme. And it may take a couple of election cycles and to see some moderate Republicans, if they indeed ever do, emerge. And that's what we need. We need some moderates on both sides that are able to work together so that the extremes are able to survive. And the Republican or the Democratic Party has moved further to the left. Even the moderates have moved further to the left. And we've seen the Republicans move further to the right. And that very important—
Let me just say something. Is authoritarianism the right? You see, I don't think the Republicans have moved to the right. I think they've moved away from democracy. Yeah. I think that's where we're getting right, left, wrong, because I think they're off that spectrum. I think where Donald Trump has taken them is not to the right. It is to a darker place.
Well, and I think on that end of the spectrum, you can also look at authoritarianism as well.
Right.
And so that's what you're talking about. I agree.
So Dean, you're the political science professor here and the government professor. And what I'm thinking is the only way we can repair this, that what the Republicans need more than anything is not just for Democrats to win. It's for Democrats to basically deal with money and politics and gerrymandering. Because as long as we embrace the art of partisan gerrymandering, we will only have extremes. And that will hurt, in some ways, Republicans more than will hurt Democrats, because Donald Trump will control those extremes. Even out of office, he'll control those extremes because of what he's done to foment this kind of Republican base. And I think that the Democrats' gift to Republicans, if we really want to have a two-party structure, is to deal with gerrymandering and make it a nonpartisan, fair gerrymandering that isn't cookie-cuttered for a Democrat or a Republican or whatever, and that they begin to pull some of this incredible money out of politics. And if they do that, then the Republican Party can begin to sort of find its soul, find its footing, and actually elect people that will govern, not people that will, I think, in fact, want to undermine the whole concept of governing.
Yeah, you know, I think certainly there have been some attempts to make the redistricting and gerrymandering less of a partisan issue. You know, we've seen a number of states move towards having kind of nonpartisan commissions. We've had difficulty getting that put into place in New Hampshire. Governor Sununu has resisted it.
He's vetoed it, not resisted. Tell what it is. Okay.
Vetoed it. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And I think the Democratic legislature may even have passed it a second time, and it didn't do any better the second time around. So it's very hard to get people to give up institutional mechanisms that perpetuate their own self-interest. And, you know, as a result, this is something I discuss with my students whenever I teach introductory American politics and we talk about Congress. You have House caucuses that are to the left and right of kind of the median American voter in both of those parties. And, you know, we all remember from the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, many members of Congress in the House who were kind of moderates and would work with, you know, moderate Democrats, would work with we used to call them liberal Republicans or Rockefeller Republicans or, et cetera. That's all gone now. The middle of the ideological spectrum in Congress is completely hollowed out, driven by the primary system. So, if Democrats are able to do that and willing to do that, rather than, you know, I recall after the 2010 census, which was a disaster for Democrats, right, in the heat of the Tea Party, you know, the Democrats started organizing a few years ago to try to do better in 2020. To hopefully get a better piece of the pie in terms of the ability to redraw districts. Now, whether they redraw those districts more fairly or kind of gerrymander in the opposite direction, we'll have to see. It's very hard. I think Democrats could do that. We've seen it's been a little more difficult to do through the courts. Well, if you're talking about partisan gerrymandering, the Supreme Court has resisted wading into that the way they have with racial gerrymandering. I think it's possible. There are some Democrats, though, who think turnabout is fair play.
No. So let me just tell who they are. They're not the progressives. Because I have been talking to progressive Democrats across the country. If they don't do a fair, balanced, honest gerrymandering, the progressives are going to balk. They don't want an unfair advantage. That's not winning. That's not winning, Dean. That's cheating.
Who's that? The progressives don't.
The progressives don't want. They want a fair gerrymandering. They don't want a gerrymandering process. They want a fair redistricting process. All their rights and democracies, all the groups they supported, they don't want something where there's a finger on the scale and their people win and the Republicans get screwed. That's not democratic. In the end, if you don't win on your ideas, what's the point? If cheating is the only way you win, and frankly, partisan gerrymandering is cheating. It is cheating. Let's call it what it is. And Rick, let me just tell you a story. There is a gerrymandered executive council district in New Hampshire. And everyone, we don't have lieutenant governors. We have this throwback to the British. It's five executive councilors. And they run in these really large districts and nobody even knows what they do. But they're actually quite powerful. But one of the districts, Rick, and you know this, was gerrymandered so it would be an absolute Democratic district because they wanted to make sure all the Democrats are pulled out from all the other districts so Republicans would win. Here's the dilemma of a gerrymandered Democratic district. I talked to a talk show host over in Keene, New Hampshire, and I said to him, are you going to have all the different executive councilors running in this gerrymandered district on the air before the primary? There are like five or six of them. He said, oh, no. I don't do that in the primary. I'm going to wait for the general. The problem is, Rick, you and I both know, if it's a gerrymandered district, there is no general election. The primary is the election. So they got screwed twice. Not only did they get forced into this ridiculous district, but people didn't give them the ability to articulate their difference because they thought, oh, it's the primary. We're going to wait for the general. Well, the general has no meaning. So now we really don't even know what the choices are because we haven't had the kind of debate and discussion between these different candidates. I just want people to understand that's what's wrong with gerrymandering. It even hurts your choice because you don't even know what you're choosing, Rick.
Yeah, and you know, that is should be taught in universities, say to students, in case you don't know what gerrymandered means, this is what it means. You've got Emmett Soldati, who's running, and I think he lives in Somersworth, and then you've got John Shea, who's running, he's a former counselor, he's over in the Keene area, and you've everybody in between, people running in Concord.
I mean, these are the opposite sides of the state, everyone.
Absolute opposite sides. This district has nothing in common. Right. One of it has nothing in common with the other. The people who live in Stratford County, which is the southern part of the state, have in all likelihood probably never, don't even know Cheshire County exists, and have no reason to ever go there.
Yeah.
It should be taught as to what gerrymandering is and why it's bad.
Let me jump in one second. Of course.
Yeah, your point is well taken, but I also think that what we're seeing with that particular race is a function of kind of the obscure nature of the executive council. I mean, people who follow politics like us understand that it's basically becoming a launch pad to run for governor. But in a lot of other states with gerrymandered districts, everybody knows the primary is the general election. And so if it's an open seat, you get 10 people running or 15 people running. And those primaries actually get a lot of coverage. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I do think part of the sort of the oddity of people ignoring the six candidates is that it's executive council. It's not, you know, doesn't have quite the same allure as a, for people who are casual observers, as say a hotly contested congressional seat. This is just a thought.
But again, the value is that you have to also educate your listeners, and your listeners should know it's after the primary, it's over, sweetheart, you know, and that much, you know, about gerrymandering. You know that primaries are consequential. And Ken, one of the women with the QAnon supporters, you know, who a Republican who won, do you know how many people voted in the state in that primary, in that district? 6%. It was a 6% turnout. So think about this, a 6% turnout, and she's now the nominee. Oh my God, not only does she represent a wild extreme, but then when you look at the handful of people, I could have had them all over for dinner. That's how few there were, Ken.
I was gonna talk about something different, but I also wanna say that one aspect of this executive council, not anybody interviewing all of the candidates and taking it seriously, is question of civic education. Because as a matter of fact, the executive council is an extremely important, has a great deal of power. It's an important role. They approve or disapprove all of the judges. So all of the fights that, you know, people notice in Capitol Hill,
judges,
Washington, that's what these guys do. They have said no to judges who are liberal, or they've said no to judges who are conservative. Now that they're dominated by Democrats, three to two Democrats in the executive council. They also approve all the contracts that the state enters into. So, my gosh, think about, you know, in D.C., all the Halliburton contracts and all of the defense contracts and everything else. I mean, that's what these folks are doing for New Hampshire. So that's a big deal. And it ought to be taken seriously. The fact that people don't know it's an important deal is a big problem. But the other thing I wanted to talk about, though, was on the gerrymandering question. And everybody is saying that we should take the high road and have it be an independent redistricting. I agree with that. And I'm a strong proponent of independent redistricting. But I have to tell you, it's difficult to take when the last time in 2010, the redistricting was done totally by the Republicans, and they really squeezed a lot of power out of it. So if we do the 2020 redistricting in a way that is totally fair, it kind of consolidates the Republican legislature in, you know, in Wisconsin, where they have the ability to override what the governor does, or in Michigan.
So Ken, you know what you're doing?
In New Hampshire.
Well, so Val, you know what Ken's doing? So now look at all the abuses of power that Donald Trump did. Does that mean that we have a license because Donald Trump was such a slime bucket and basically abuse power and abuse his executive suite, that because he did it, that's a license for Biden and Harris to do it? A pox on that. We can't, this is a slippery slope, Val. This is the problem. Because exactly what Ken is saying, and Ken, you hold yourself up as being this virtuous attorney, but yet you're angry still from 2010. You don't think I'm angry from 2010? But my anger with 2010 doesn't mean I want to even smell like 2010.
We should at least even the playing field, Arnie. Not take over and own everything, but we should at least have some kind of fair.
Make it fair. But Val.
I also wanted to say that you have to look at this in terms of the kind of power that executives find themselves using. And Donald Trump wasn't the first one who used the executive order. And when Obama used the executive order, people had warned that this was setting a very dangerous precedent for presidents going forward. And nobody dreamed that there would be a Donald Trump. And that's the problem when you think I'm just going to use it this one time or during this administration because there are some crucial issues and I've got to act on them and I can't count on Congress. That gave license for Donald Trump to do what he's doing. Right. So I think that we have to be very cautious and hold executives' feet to the fire about the kinds of powers that they're deploying.
Well, so Dean, as I'm listening to Val, all of a sudden now we thought that, you know, there were norms. I now hate the word norms because Donald Trump has completely blown up the concept of norms. Norms is whatever, you know, Donald wakes up to and tweets about. So, I mean, this is really going to force, it's going to be very interesting because I think this is the one time where Republicans and Democrats might have a kumbaya. If the Democrats win the presidency, Dean Spiliotis, and they decide to start putting into law so that we don't have to assume that the norms are what we're going to depend on, we need to actually have it written down in black and white so we know that this is really how you're to behave. I bet you the Republicans will support it because they'll then see controls on the Democratic president when they didn't have controls on the Republican president. It was fine when it was their boy, but now that it's our boy, they're suddenly going to say, oh yeah, let's pass it because we want to make sure there are constraints, Dean.
Yeah, possibly. I'm just not sure, Arnie. I've read a lot of the discussion of the Hatch Act and whether or not it should explicitly include the president and the vice president and have, you know, additional conditions so that if we don't have a repeat of the RNC show and at the White House. And it's, I don't have a good feel yet of whether or not, you know, if we get to the place that you're suggesting, if everybody's going to say, you know, hold on, let's not try to over circumscribe this. But it is interesting, you know, when I teach the presidential congressional relations, there's a whole literature based on the idea of institutional reciprocity. And that sounds like almost a quaint term now. I mean, I've been teaching that term for 25 years, doesn't really apply anymore.
No.
But that was, you know, that was the thinking that, you know, there are these literally norms of reciprocity that keeps the whole system that Madison designed, the checks and balances, separation of powers, in an equilibrium. And that whole system is just, we're finding out now, that the equilibrium isn't as easy to nurture than maybe people thought it would be.
Okay, we need to go to a break. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week with Val Endres, Dean Spiliotis, and Rick Newman. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Basic income is what we want. Basic income is what the people need. Basic income all over the world. To break the chains of poverty. First class, no more second class, no more third class, citizens of any nation. Basic income to break poverty. No more first class, no more second class, no more third class, no.
Welcome back to Part 2 of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week with Rick Newman, former state representative, lobbyist Val Endres, a professor at Rhode Island College of Political Communication, and Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar and a professor of government. So, Rick, this is Labor Day weekend. People are going to actually hear this show on Labor Day. So I want to begin our second half with actually focusing on what I think is actually very important about this weekend. And there was a piece at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it was entitled, "With So Many Out of Work, It's a Labor Day Like No Other." And it was an editorial written by the editorial staff. So everybody sort of weighed in on this. And let me just do the opening sentences. "The coronavirus pandemic has not only driven the economy into a recession, but fundamentally changed the relationship between workers and their workplace. That makes this a Labor Day like no other. Some changes, such as work from home for those privileged enough to have a job that can be done remotely, might become permanent features of the economy. A socially distant world meant some jobs disappeared, like those in the entertainment sector, and other jobs became newly essential, although early recognition and respect of frontline workers might prove to have been short-lived. Work-related tasks and challenges also changed, including enforcing sanitation and mask requirements, risking infection in the workplace, and managing a child's school day while working. Oh my God, Rick, this is the biggest change I think ever to work. And I think who's gonna be the most shocked by this are owners of commercial properties, because commercial properties assumed office space, assumed a certain level of retail space, maybe even assumed a certain level of entertainment and tourism and restaurant space. And this pandemic has changed our relationship to all those things, Rick.
Well, you know, it has. And if they get a vaccine 6 months, a year from now, whatever, I think we may have institutionalized these changes by then. You know, and if you think about just in your everyday life, well, if you think, New Hampshire shut down March 16th, essentially. And prior to that, I live in Nottingham. It's a 26-mile drive to Concord. I typically went there 5 days a week, and I typically used about a tank of gas a week. So whatever that did to the economy, it did, right? And you multiply that by the hundreds of thousands of people that drive to work every day. Well, between March 16th and June 16th, I think I bought four tanks of gas. So instead of buying about 17 or 18 tanks of gas, I bought four. Because I didn't go anywhere. I worked from home the whole time. And all the other things I would have done, I would have bought a coffee, I would have bought a lunch. You know, I would have stopped and maybe bought whoever. Whatever it was I would have done, I didn't do. And that affected the economy. I think you're absolutely right about it when I think about people I know who work in big cities who have been told, don't plan on coming back to the office. People are going to end up working remotely. Even my daughter, who's a 39-year-old special ed teacher, is looking at the future of this year, working from her home and teaching kids, you know, from her home. I think we're in for kind of a shaking out of the economy, and it's going to take some time for us to figure it out. And some of us, as you said, are lucky to be able to work from home. The folks on the frontline jobs, the one thing we've got to do, we've got to pay these people. You cannot keep, yes. It is a disgrace to say the people who kept us going are getting paid $7.25 an hour. That's a disgrace.
So Val, as I'm listening to Rick, there's a couple of things I think about. So I'm privileged because I can Zoom with you, all right? You can be in Rhode Island, you can be anywhere in New Hampshire, we've had people from Portugal that we've Zoomed with, okay? And that's wonderful. But let me tell you what I hate about it. It's reinforcing our lack of social interaction. That there is something I miss about not being in a studio where there's another human being, because all those relationships and all those contacts that happen and all those reinforcers of who we are as a family person, as an employee, as a girl or a boy, all those disappear when you suddenly work remotely. And I mean, I heard a story about, I think it was Pinterest, you know, basically canceled. It's, you know, they were buying floors and floors of space in some building, I don't know, it was in California or whatever, and they canceled it. They're not gonna be doing it. Their people are gonna be working from home. Well, that may save them some money, but I'm thinking about the relationships that are gonna be so strained now because we're all so isolated. I hated Facebook. I hated social media before. Now I'm terrified, Val.
Well, there are a couple of things that are happening here, but I think you're absolutely right about this. The changes that we're seeing right now are speeding up, but they were inevitable to begin with because in major cities, commercial property has become so expensive. And on the other hand, we're also seeing monopolies and consolidation of businesses. So when commercial properties are very expensive, smaller businesses can't grow large because they can't get a foothold. Right. And so that has led to this whole notion of of working from home, even for large companies, because they can save huge amounts of money by doing so. But you're absolutely right about the communication focus. And what just sort of as an interesting aside, we have a number of majors that come to our department, and some of those are nursing and medical imaging. And the reason that they're taking communication courses is that their supervisors in hospitals and healthcare facilities have said that they have lost the art of conversation and communication with the patients. And part of that comes from the fact that they make their friendships and maintain their friendships through social media and through texting. And just like we talked about Congress, that Congress doesn't go out to eat and they don't talk together. Exactly. And it leads to, it makes it very easy to exaggerate the divisions between the party and to call each other's names because, you know, they're coming home rather than staying in Washington. So they're not going to their kids' dance recitals and meet other people there. And so the whole idea of having cross-aisle friendships has nearly disappeared. And the same thing happens also in the workplace. It increases rancor and competition in the workplace because people don't get to know each other or see each other and develop relationships, on top of the fact that their ability to communicate effectively face-to-face is almost non-existent.
So Dean, there was a wonderful, I put a statistic in our attitude sort of conversation for today, and it was from Dean Baker. And Dean Baker is an economist with CEPR. And he said, here's a fun fact. And the fun fact was, if we were consistently raising the minimum wage the way we were doing it in the 60s and the 70s, the minimum wage today, everyone, would be $24, Dean. $24 an hour, okay? You know, we're trying to figure out how to do the glide path to 15, you know, and I'm looking at the cost of my mortgage and I'm looking at the cost of school. You know, all those things went up, like minimum wage should have gone up. I mean, when I went to college back in the 1970s, the cost of tuition, room and board was like $4,000, you know, between four, and that was for a good school in the Midwest. Now, what is it today? I think it's like 50,000 or 60,000. That's a 10 and 12 fold increase. Well, imagine if we had a 10 and 12 fold increase in minimum wage to keep up with all those bills and housing costs and car costs and all those other things. So I think not only is the whole idea of the changing relationship with work scary, but another reason to pay our frontline workers, you know, the people that are in the hospitals, the people that are in the grocery stores, the people that are picking the vegetables, is that we equate money with respect. And when you don't pay people that do those jobs, in a way you don't respect them, Dean.
Well, you also pay people based on willingness to assume risk. That's why we talk about things like hazardous duty pay, where you pay people more when they're willing to accept a greater risk. And it's interesting just listening to Rick and then listening to Val and an earlier discussion that I heard today about the whole discussion is about whether or not we're going to have a V-shaped recovery or a U-shaped recovery. And now people are talking about a K-shaped recovery in which, you know, the up sort of the white collar professionals kind of go up like the upper arm of a K, and essential workers and others who are out there on the front lines actually drop like the lower arm of a K. If you think of the letter K, and, you know, there's some truth to that. Just thinking as I was listening to Rick and Val, you know, most of my friends who are professionals, you know, lawyers, doctors, professors, et cetera, many of them worked in major cities and office buildings every day. They're all working from home now, but they're all still working and still getting paid. And in many cases, their firms are actually doing just fine. And the stock market's doing pretty good, too, for everybody's, you know, 401k. So this pandemic, unfortunately, is emphasizing or further emphasizing kind of this sort of two-tiered economy. And it really comes down to this issue of what can we do as a society for the folks who find themselves sliding down that lower rung of the K the K recovery? And that's one of the big questions.
And you know, I'm a progressive, and the progressive in me says, so rather than enhance the K, what you need to do is you need to make sure that you have not a safety net, but there is a certain assumption, just the way we have an assumption with public education, we now have to have an assumption with higher education and worker training. That is not something that you have to pay for. It is something that you get because you're a citizen or a resident. We have to start looking at healthcare, because those essential workers you were just talking about, who take on more risk than me, who sits home in her little loft and Zooms, I'm not going to probably get COVID because I don't have to interact with anyone. But think of the people that are working at hospitals. Think of the people that are working at grocery stores. Think of the people that are cutting hair.
The number of people at grocery stores who have died is just frightening. Yes.
The number of police who have died, the number of firefighters who have died. So I am telling you that because of them, because they're embracing such risk, not only do you want them to get cash, but you want them to know that if they get sick and have to leave their job, they don't have to worry about healthcare. They don't have to worry about whether their kid can afford to go to college. How else do you reward them for doing the work that's the Velcro that keeps us together? I'm sorry, Val, but as I listen to this, I get so scared. And I know, Rick, you and I disagree. We're on the different ends of the Democratic spectrum here. But I am telling you right now, a pox on insurance companies that tell me whether I'm in network or out of network. A pox on insurance companies that are going to charge me for the kind of condition that you may get because of COVID-19 that is permanent. A pox on insurance companies that are going to charge you who knows how many thousands of dollars for this test or this vaccine. In the end, we need all of us to be healthy, and it shouldn't be an incredible cost, Rick.
Well, I totally agree with that. Listen, my biggest complaint with Barack Obama is that he did, in my opinion, a really stupid move in that he wanted to have a bipartisan health insurance or health plan. And so he compromised, and ended up not getting one single Republican vote. So why didn't you just say, we're going to give everybody health coverage, period? And everybody could get a basic plan. And then if you wanted to buy something additional and you could afford it, that's your business. But I get covered, you get covered, all God's children get covered. And, that's the way it should have been. And because of this ridiculous desire to say, let's bring everyone into the fold, which, you know, I watched New Hampshire do that. New Hampshire does it with their budget. You know, I watch the Democrats sit in their budget and they adopt amendment after amendment after amendment from conservative members of the legislature in hopes of bringing it into a bipartisan budget. And then those people all vote against the budget anyway. And the same thing happens when the Republicans are in control and they do the same thing, that they adopt Democratic amendments and then the Democrats vote against the budget anyway. So the hell with it. Why don't you just do what you want to do, what you should have done, and then let the chips fall where they may? You know, we had an opportunity. They got 60 votes for Obamacare. They could have got 60 votes for Medicare for All or for some kind of national health insurance. And they
But you know what scares me about that conversation we're having right now, Rick? Val, what scares me about that is, who was his VP? Joe Biden. What do I hear from Joe Biden? He's back in the 1960s and the 1970s. He's doing the bipartisan thing. He's doing he's assuming the old Republican Party. He's like in a time warp. And when you listen to him, and you know, he's the one who said, you know, he talks about healthcare, Val, as a right, but I don't know what kind of a right he's talking about. You know, maybe he used a pen that writes. I just don't know. But I don't think it's a right for some kind of healthcare. And again, I worry about the fact that once again we're gonna go in, and especially now because of the pandemic, when healthcare is front and center on everybody's head, you know, in their heads, that we're going to cave and pre-negotiate before we even get into the fight, Val.
And I must say too, healthcare is going to become more and more critical because of these issues of COVID-19. And we've all read the articles that it's a vascular disease. Even with the young people who are getting it, they're likely to have long-term effects. And so what Obama did in many ways is still pile on and make the health insurance industry bureaucratically laden. And so, for example, I'm a state employee, but we've changed insurance companies 3 times. I just got a bill for $500 because I went out of network and didn't know it. And I have some of the best insurance in the state. Right. And so you can imagine what happens, for example, to my students who have minimal insurance with high deductibles, and they get COVID, they're not going to go to the doctor. And any kind of long-term effects that they have, or even short-term effects, aren't going to be covered, so they won't go. So we're raising one of the most unhealthy generations in this country because they can't afford health insurance.
Indeed, as I'm listening to Val, one of the things I go crazy about is we keep talking about how we suddenly realize how porous our public health system is, that we really haven't invested in our public health. Well, the first way to invest in public health is to do what Rick said. Give everyone some kind of health insurance. There's no value in my neighbor not having it and me having it. There's no value when my neighbor loses their job. Not only are they worried about paying the rent and paying the heat and paying the food, but now they're worried about what happens if they get sick. Because if they get sick, I could get sick. I mean, let me be selfish here. I want them to stay in their house. I want them to have food on their table, and God help them if they get sick. In a funny way, I keep saying, aren't we our brother's keeper? We really are. We need to care about them because in a funny way, it's being selfish. It's about caring about yourself. And if they're unstable and they're unwell and they are frightened because they've lost their jobs, why would you want to pile on and tell them they're on their own, Jack, when it comes to being able to go to a doctor, especially having the experience of a pandemic?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've seen it. As a country, we've struggled with this notion of community, that if I wear a mask, that's a communal good, not just a personal good, and that there's inherent and intrinsic benefit to everybody taking care of each other. You know, the question for me, as I've started thinking about it a little bit, is if Biden is elected, what's going to happen with Obamacare? What kind of changes are going to come down the pike? How willing is Biden to kind of move towards Medicare for all, and or will the progressives be able to pull him in that direction? I mean, part of it will depend on what happens to the Senate. If Republicans hold the Senate, it makes it a little bit easier for Biden to kind of go slow. If Democrats take Congress completely, then maybe there'd be more pressure on him. But it's hard to get a sense from him. I think his campaign views kind of the whole Medicare for all as kind of an unnecessary kind of third rail in terms of just kind of campaign strategy, that they can just kind of stay away from it from now. But other than saying he's going to preserve Obamacare, I don't really have a sense yet of, you know, how we move towards the communal notion that you're suggesting.
He right. said he'd veto it. Hasn't Biden
sort of implied that he would veto it?
Veto Medicare for all?
Veto what?
Medicare for all?
I don't know.
A universal health care.
Well,
I thought he said it since he was nominated.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what our economy looks like, what the pandemic looks like, what the long-term consequences that his scientists are going to tell him. He keeps telling me, I listen to the scientists, I listen to the doctors. Well, the scientists and doctors are talking about the long-term consequences of COVID, that, you know, it's like a disability. Even if you don't show signs of COVID, you still could have some kind of long-term consequences, which means we might have millions of people who might have been healthy at birth, might have been healthy before the pandemic, but because of COVID, now they have something that nobody planned for financially and nobody planned for.
Yeah, like dialysis is turning out to be something. A lot of people are experiencing real kidney failure. Even if they recover, their right. kidneys are permanently damaged, and now they're on dialysis for the rest of their life.
All right, so we have to end this way. So there is an Atlantic blockbuster, Rick Newman, about Donald Trump and his relationship with the U.S. military. And it wasn't exactly a positive relationship. In fact, it was about disparaging remarks he made about veterans. And the remarks are not surprising, in part because if you followed what he said about John McCain, and you sort of followed what he said about some of the people that actually came to work from him, like whether it was Mattis or Kelly or whatever, you know that, you know, he creates the illusion when he's in front of a group of vets and writes them like some kind of a check that sort of says, I care about you. But then in reality, when it is about sort of revering them and respecting their risk and understanding their patriotism and that they're putting their life on the line, he kind of rolls his eyes and goes, boy, are you schmucks. And Rick, this story is interesting because there's too much to support it, even if we don't even know who the anonymous sources were that were well-sourced. The most important source is Donald Trump's mouth, Rick Newman.
Yes. Look, so in his defense, he comes out and says, there were two parts of the story, but one of them talked about John McCain, and we all know how he disparaged John McCain. But he actually tweeted just a few days ago, I never called John McCain a loser. And then, of course, there's video of him calling John McCain a loser. So we know you lied about that, Donald. So then when you go on to say, I never said loser and sucker regarding people who serve in the military, any parent would look at the child and say, I know you just lied about eating the cookie because I see the crumbs on your shirt collar. So you're lying about your sister eating it. And that's what we know about him. Yeah. But you know what's more important is, think about him. You opened the show with Colonel Vindman.
Yeah.
This man was a heroic figure in the United States military. Donald Trump took less than 5 seconds to throw him under the bus because he testified truthfully under oath, under subpoena. Okay? If you are a military advocate, that's really all you need to know about Donald Trump and the way he views people in the military. So that's what you need to know, do you believe him or not? If you're a jury, you don't have to have a video and a station wagon full of nuns to verify what is being alleged. You look at the comportment of a man's life, you say, no, he said it. He said it about my father. My father served in World War II.
Yeah. So, Val, as I'm thinking
he
about
it, disparaged every single person that served in the United States military.
Well, and in some ways, it's almost worse because right now we have a voluntary military. And what we know about the, so that means that these people were not, they didn't get drafted. They didn't need a doctor to write them a note. They didn't like, you know, what is it? Bone spurs, whatever he had. These people actually enlist. And a lot of them enlisted after 9/11. A lot of them saw what happened and it was a call to patriotism. They wanted to respond to protect their country. But the other thing we know about the US military, it's the one place where if you are a person of color, you can succeed in the US military. And the other thing that the US military has been, it has been also a place where unfortunately, if you are looking for opportunity, and opportunity doesn't exist because there's so much racism in this country, and you are denied opportunity in order to get more schooling or denied opportunity to get the job, if you enlist, it opens so many doors. So in a lot of ways, the US military is a twofer for Donald Trump. He doesn't like diversity and people of color, and he thinks if you signed up and you enlisted, you're a schmuck. I mean, you're supposed to be making money because if you don't come home with commas in your checks, what's the point?
Many of the statements that Donald Trump makes are those revelations. He approaches them with sorry, not sorry. That is, it provides red meat for his base. But this one cuts a little bit differently. And I think we saw when we had that impromptu press conference by the plane at night, we saw a panicked Donald Trump because he realizes what the implications of this might be. There are some people who are, you know, engaged in the military who will still vote for Donald Trump, but I think the trends are, I know Biden is ahead with military personnel. And we may see, if he keeps this up, we may see a big swing. But this, to me, was one of his most outrageous statements. And that cuts through generations. There's not a family or very few people who don't know somebody who died in Vietnam, in World War II. We're proud of our veterans. We may not always agree with going to war, but we understand that we stay away from criticizing the veterans. And in some ways, this was a bridge too far.
Well, so Dean, as I'm thinking about Donald Trump and the US military and what does it mean, I'm hearing now that in a lot of the sort of upper echelons, the National War College, whatever, they're beginning to talk about when do you disobey the orders coming down from the president. They're literally having conversations about what is the highest authority. What should you do? And that's something that maybe they might have talked about and it might have been a throwaway conversation. But now this is a front and center conversation, especially after Donald Trump did that thing with the Bible in front of the White House and walked across and used the military as being sort of his backdrop shtick. I think people are beginning to realize they may be in a position where they're going to be asked to do something that they know is unconstitutional and a violation of their oath and their authority.
Yeah, and we saw this conversation begin just recently with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, who said, just to let you folks know up front, if there's any kind of dispute with the election, the U.S. military is not getting involved in settling domestic politics. So that's just the tip of the iceberg, I think, of this discussion is all over the leadership of the U.S. military now.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Thank you, Val Endres from Rhode Island College, Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, and Rick Newman, my favorite lobbyist. Anyway, we will talk to you tomorrow. Ciao. Have a wonderful Labor Day. Ciao.
Hi there, folks. You know, these days it seems like more and more people are just out for themselves. I gotta tell you, maybe because the outlook for the future is so uncertain. People can turn on you and act like they never even knew you. Just put right under the bus.